Picture a traditional coastal fishing village in West Africa.
Oh, specifically along the coast of Ghana, right?
Exactly, yeah. So you have these narrow wooden canoes lining the shore, and the smell of salt and wood smoke is just hanging heavy in the air.
Yeah, and you've got fishers mending their nets under this just punishing sun.
Right. It is a scene that is driven entirely by the day-to-day realities of local survival. But now I want you to take that mental image and hold it up right next to a completely different one.
Okay, I'm with you.
Picture a massive, opulent, luxury wedding banquet in a high-rise in, say, China or Hong Kong.
Oh, wow. Okay, quite the contrast.
Yeah, I mean, you've got crystal chandeliers, hundreds of wealthy guests, and a menu that is designed specifically to project sheer status and power to everyone in that room.
Right, it's all about signaling wealth.
Exactly. So the question is, how do these two entirely different worlds, I mean, they are separated by thousands of miles and vastly different economic realities, how do they become directly tethered to one another?
It is such a striking juxtaposition. I mean, you have one community pulling a resource from the ocean, literally just to secure their next meal, and another community utilizing that exact same resource to signal their prosperity.
Yeah, and the invisible thread connecting those two realities is pulled incredibly tight.
It really is. It creates this ripple effect that touches everything from, local West African politics to the global survival of an entire species.
And that invisible thread is the focus of our deep dive today. We are looking at a 2024 scientific report from the Journal of Wildlife and Biodiversity.
Right. It's titled A Closer Look at Socioeconomic and Management Perspectives of Shark Fishery in Ghana.
Yes, and our mission today is to uncover the hidden high-stakes supply chain of the global shark fin trade.
Which is just, it's a massive, massive topic.
It is. We are going to explore the intense paradox of a local fishery where human survival is relying heavily on an animal that is rapidly facing global extinction.
And, to really grasp the gravity of what is happening in Ghana, we have to pull back and look at the global context first.
Right, set the stage for us.
Well, worldwide, shark populations have plummeted by an estimated 70% over the last half century.
70%. That's a staggering drop.
It's terrifying,
Yeah.
honestly. And according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the IUCN, nearly a quarter of all shark species are currently considered vulnerable or endangered.
Wow.
Yeah. And what makes this decline so incredibly precarious is the fundamental biology of the shark itself. They are what biologists call evolutionarily conservative.
Meaning they invest a massive amount of time and energy into very few offspring, right? Like rather than just releasing thousands of eggs into the current and hoping for the best.
Exactly. That is the core of the issue. I mean, unlike a lot of smaller commercial fish, say, a sardine that reproduces by the thousands in just a matter of months, sharks have incredibly long life cycles.
Right. They take forever to grow up.
Yes. Many species require at least 15 years just to reach sexual maturity. And some take even longer than that.
So they have these long gestation periods and they give birth to very few pups.
Right. So when you pull a mature breeding shark out of the ocean,
Yeah.
you aren't just removing one fish, you are removing decades of biological investment.
You are severing this very slow, fragile reproductive chain that the whole ecosystem relies on to maintain balance.
Precisely.
Okay, let's unpack this because one of the most surprising takeaways from this research is that in Ghana, pulling those sharks out of the ocean was not always the main goal.
No, not at all.
For a very long time, this wasn't some targeted hunt.
Right. Historically, if a shark ended up in a Ghanaian fisher's net, it was considered bycatch, just an accident.
Like a nuisance, almost.
Exactly. The meat itself wasn't highly prized on the commercial market, so it was mostly just chopped up and used as bait.
Wait, they just used it as bait.
Yeah. They used the shark to catch the fish they actually wanted to sell, which were higher value commercial species like tuna, anchovies, or mackerel. The shark was simply a means to an end.
But then the global market shifted, and suddenly the Ghanaian coastline experienced what I can only really describe as an aquatic gold rush.
Oh, absolutely.
The explosion of the Asian market demand for shark products, specifically the fins for shark fin soup, it just completely rewrote the rule book for these coastal communities.
What did? And to give you an idea of the peak of this frenzy, around 2013, shark fins were being reported to retail at up to 350 euros per kilogram globally.
350 euros per kilogram. That is, it's as if you were digging in a coal mine for years, totally ignoring these annoying hard rocks getting in your way.
Right.
And suddenly someone from halfway across the world tells you those rocks are diamonds. You aren't a coal miner anymore. You're a diamond miner.
That financial incentive changed the entire dynamic of the fishery. I mean, when the international market expanded, the economic value of these fins skyrocketed to a level that local fishers simply could not ignore.
Especially as their traditional catches were starting to dwindle, right?
Exactly. But I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, because conservationists often, you know, villainize the shark fin trade.
Which makes sense on the surface.
Right. But the report notes that about 10% of Ghana's entire population depends directly or indirectly on fish resources for their livelihood.
10%? That's roughly 2.6 million people.
Exactly. So if the traditional tuna and mackerel are disappearing due to overfishing and climate change, aren't the conservationists basically asking these people to starve to save a fish?
What's fascinating here is you are hitting on the exact rational economics driving this entire system.
Right.
We cannot look at this through a purely ecological lens without looking at the human element. West African marine environments are facing intense compounding pressure.
Oh, for sure. Declining overall aquatic resources. Foreign industrial trawlers just depleting fish stocks.
And massive biodiversity loss. When your traditional catch is disappearing, you have to find a new survival strategy. The local fishers are acting entirely rationally.
You adapt to the new market, or you lose your livelihood entirely.
Right. And that adaptation was swift. Entire communities shifted their focus. The economic gain from selling shark fins on the international level, combined with consuming the meat on the local level, created this massive, dual-layered incentive.
Yeah, and the study points out an incredible statistic. Some fishers and traders in these regions now generate between 80 and 100% of their total income strictly from shark fisheries.
100%.
Yeah. It is no longer accidental bycatch.
Mm-hmm.
The shark is the foundation of their microeconomy.
Okay, so having established that this is a deliberate, targeted hunt driven by survival, we have to look at what they're actually pulling out of the water.
Right, the specific species.
And the researchers didn't just look at broad, abstract national data. They went right to the source. They surveyed 91 fishers across four major Ghanaian landing sites, Apim, Dikskov, Tima, and Axim.
And getting that kind of localized, on-the-ground field data is just invaluable. It gives us a clear snapshot of both the marine ecosystem's current state and the specific economic pressures acting on it daily.
And the catch data from these four sites is super revealing. The dominant species caught making up a massive 68% of the survey's pie chart is the blue shark.
Right. Huge chunk.
But they are also pulling in significant numbers of the milk shark and, importantly, the scalloped hammerhead. But as the research points out, not all shark fins are created equal in the eyes of the international market. There is a very specific demand.
Yes, there is a rigid economic hierarchy based entirely on the physical properties of the fins. Hammerhead sharks account for 51% of the high-value fins identified in the study.
The 51%.
Yeah, and bull sharks make up another 24% of that premium category.
So what is the mechanism behind that preference? Like, why are buyers paying top dollar for a hammerhead fin over a blue shark fin?
Well, it really comes down to culinary texture and processing durability. The fins of hammerheads and bull sharks have a very high concentration of ceratotrichia.
Cerato what?
Ceratotrichia. They are these stiff, needle-like collagen fibers that give the fin its shape.
Oh.
See, in a dish like shark fin soup, the fin itself doesn't actually provide the flavor the broth does. The fin provides a very specific gelatinous, stringy texture that is just highly prized.
Oh, I see.
Because hammerhead and bull shark fins are physically tougher, larger, and packed with these collagen fibers, they hold up incredibly well during the intense drying and cooking processes.
But that specific culinary preference has a devastating biological side effect, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It places an immense targeted bullseye on these specific species.
Yep.
The hammerheads and the bull sharks are experiencing a drastic, accelerated population decline because they literally carry the highest bounty on their heads.
Which is wild because they are already classified by the IUCN Red List as endangered species.
Right. But because the market discriminates based on that collagen texture, the financial incentive to hunt them remains incredibly high, completely regardless of their endangered status.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because this is where the daily realities of fishing clash with the economic incentives in a totally unexpected way.
Oh, the seasonality data, yes.
Right. When you look at the actual seasonality of when these sharks are caught, it completely flips what you would naturally assume about fishing logic.
Right, because Ghana experiences a major marine event called an upwelling season from June to October.
And for those unfamiliar, an upwelling is an oceanographic phenomenon where cold, dense, nutrient-rich water from the deep ocean rises to the surface.
Yeah, it essentially fertilizes the surface waters, leading to massive blooms of phytoplankton, which in turn attracts just massive schools of fish.
It is the absolute peak time for fish production. So logically, you would assume that shark catches would peak right in the middle of this bounty, right?
Right.
I mean, more nutrients mean more small fish, mm-hmm. which means more large predators like sharks coming in to feed on them.
It seems like basic common sense. You fish where the food chain is most active.
But the data in the report shows something completely different. The shark catches actually drop off a cliff after August, right in the middle of this peak season.
Wait, really?
Yeah. In August, the researchers recorded 416 sharks caught. By September, that number plummeted to 147.
Wow.
So why are Ghanaian fishers catching significantly fewer sharks during the most abundant fishing season of the entire year?
It all comes back to risk assessment and the economic decision-making of the fishers. During that major upwelling season, highly lucrative pelagic fish, which are the fast-moving, schooling fish that travel the open ocean, like tuna and sardines, they return to the coastal waters in massive numbers.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and when those traditional schooling fish return, the fishers immediately abandon the targeted shark hunt.
Because it's a completely different style of fishing, right? Like, you can pull up thousands of sardines in a single net relatively safely.
Precisely. Catching a live apex predator on a long line or thrashing in a net is physically dangerous and incredibly time-consuming.
Yeah, I bet.
Catching a massive net full of schooling sardines during an upwelling is a much safer bet, and it provides a reliable, immediate volume of profit.
So during the first half of the year, the lean season before the upwelling shark fishing is their survival strategy.
Exactly. They fish for sharks to make ends meet while they wait for the pelagic fish to return.
And this seasonal shift creates a fascinating ripple effect on the global market price. If we look at the supply and demand curve during the lean season, the overall abundance of marine life is low.
Right.
So even though fishers are actively targeting sharks, there are simply fewer sharks around to catch. That scarcity drives the price of the fin up to an average of $48.70 per kilogram locally.
But during the peak upwelling season, the dynamic flips. Even though fishers strongly prefer targeting tuna and abandon the dedicated shark hunt, there is such a massive abundance of marine life drawn in by the nutrients that sharks are frequently caught anyway as bycatch.
So they still catch them, just not on purpose.
Exactly. And because they are more plentiful overall during the upwelling, that relative abundance drops the local price down to about $30.90 per kilogram.
That is fascinating. So you have these massive animals being hauled out of the water largely during the lean season just to keep these coastal economies afloat. But a shark fin is tiny compared to the whole animal. What happens to the remaining 95% of the shark once it hits the Ghanaian shore?
This is where we see the animal divided to serve two completely different economies. The shark is not just being harvested for its fins to be exported. The meat itself plays a critical role in local food security, highlighting why a simple ban on shark fishing is so complicated to enforce.
The report is very clear that the meat does not go to waste. In fact, 42% of the shark product utilized in these local communities is fermented.
Fermented, wow.
Yeah, and if you are listening to this and cringing at the idea of fermented shark meat, think of it like the pungent blue cheese or the strong fish sauce you might have in your own fridge right now.
Okay, that makes sense.
In Ghana, fermented shark meat is a highly popular, strongly flavored condiment used in the preparation of everyday local dishes.
And beyond the flavor, we have to look at the mechanics of preservation. In many of these coastal villages, robust cold chain logistics like industrial freezers and reliable electricity are simply not available.
Right, you can't just throw it in the freezer.
No, you can't. Fermentation is a traditional, highly effective method of preserving protein in a hot climate without refrigeration. It provides essential dietary protein and nutrition security to coastal dwellers who might otherwise struggle to afford it.
So the body of the shark stays to feed the village. But the Finns embark on this massive international journey. The data shows the primary foreign markets identified by the fishers are China, taking about 18% of the exported product, and Togo with 14%, alongside places like Hong Kong.
But this is where the report uncovers a massive structural socioeconomic failure within the system.
Oh, how so?
Well, it reveals a deeply inequitable supply chain. Remember your analogy about the coal miner finding a diamond?
Yeah.
The miner still doesn't own the trucks. The people taking 100% of the physical risks, the Ghanaian fishers in the canoes, are almost entirely separated from the massive wealth generated by their catch at the final destination.
The numbers on this are staggering. According to the study, 82.4% of these fishers deal strictly with middlemen, intermediaries.
82%.
Yeah, and even more shockingly, 58.2% of the fishers have absolutely no idea what the final market price is for the fins they just risked their lives to secure.
They are completely isolated from the market data. To understand how this works on the ground, just imagine a fisher pulling his canoe onto the beach after a grueling, dangerous day on the water.
Okay.
A local buyer is waiting there, often with a refrigerated truck or coolers. The buyer dictates the price. The fisher doesn't have a smartphone app tracking the daily commodities index in Hong Kong. He just knows he needs cash today to buy food for his family and pre-mix fuel for tomorrow's trip.
So he just takes the cash.
He takes the cash.
But wait, why can't that fisher just bypass the guy on the beach, pack the fin in ice, and sell it directly to a buyer in Asia to keep that massive profit?
Because exporting high-value wildlife products internationally requires immense capital and infrastructure. You need cold storage logistics, you need to navigate international shipping routes, you need export permits, and you need established contacts who speak the language of the final market.
And the fishers have none of that.
None of it. That is why West African countries like Togo and Ivory Coast act as vital intermediary hubs. The local buyer on the beach takes the fin to Togo, aggregates it with thousands of others, and an international exporter handles the shipping to Asia.
The fishers are trapped at the very bottom of a highly lucrative pyramid.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the harsh, on-the-ground reality of what it takes to be at the bottom of that pyramid. We've been discussing global supply chains and macroeconomics, but the survey also asked these fishers about the daily physical challenges of their job.
Right, the day-to-day grind.
And 22.5% of them explicitly cited the sheer danger of the work. We are talking about pulling a live, thrashing, several hundred-pound predator into a narrow wooden canoe using basic nets or hand lines.
It is incredibly hazardous labor.
Yeah.
A single mistake can result in capsizing, severe injury, or death. And that danger is compounded by local structural and political issues.
Oh, like the fuel issue.
Yes. Another 22.5% of the fishers cited inadequate access to pre-mixed fuel as a major operational challenge.
The fuel issue is fascinating because it exposes a hidden layer of local friction. The report explains that the government distributes subsidized premix fuel based on a headcount of local registered fishers in a specific community.
Right.
But shark fishing is often a migratory profession. Fishers follow the catch along the coast. Because these migrant fishers aren't recognized as permanent locals by the community committees, they get excluded from the subsidized fuel distributions.
Which is just devastating for them.
They are forced to buy fuel at exorbitant black market prices, slicing their already thin profit margins even further.
But if we connect all these daily struggles, the physical danger of the canoes, the political friction of the fuel shortages, the exploitation by the middlemen, they are all overshadowed by the ultimate ecological reality closing in on them.
Right.
When the researchers asked the fishers to name their number one challenge, the highest response, coming from 25.4% of them, was simply that the sharks are disappearing.
They aren't in denial. They see it happening in real time.
They are acutely aware of the depletion. They see it in their nets every single day. They are working longer hours, burning more expensive fuel, taking more physical risks, and hauling in fewer sharks.
The collapse of the marine ecosystem isn't some abstract scientific projection mapped out in a university lab. It is their immediate daily economic reality.
Yeah, exactly.
So how does this get fixed? Because marching into a coastal village that relies on this trade for up to 100% of its income and saying, you need to stop fishing to save the ocean, is not a solution. It's a recipe for starvation.
Oh, absolutely.
The researchers outline several pragmatic recommendations, but implementing them is where the real friction lies.
The foundational recommendation of the study is that any conservation effort must start by recognizing the socioeconomic needs of the fishers. You cannot mandate ecological sustainability without first ensuring economic stability.
That makes total sense.
From there, they recommend developing species-specific action plans. Instead of a blanket ban on all shark fishing, management should focus intensely on protecting the most vulnerable, high-value species, like the hammerheads and bull sharks, whose populations are crashing fastest.
But practically speaking, how does a fisher in the middle of the night distinguish a bull shark from a blue shark when it's tangled in a net?
Right, it's not easy.
That requires intense training on safe release techniques, assuming the shark even survives the initial capture. The researchers also highlight a very immediate practical need: supplying affordable personal protective equipment, or PPE.
Which is huge for safety.
But what does PPE for shark fishing even look like? We are talking about heavy-duty, cut-resistant gloves, specialized line cutters, and safety gear that is completely out of reach for a migrant fisher struggling to buy engine fuel.
Which is why the final recommendation is perhaps the most critical: initiating robust community education programs to foster voluntary co-managed conservation.
Voluntary being the keyword there.
Exactly. Top-down bans imposed by foreign NGOs rarely work in these environments. But if the fishers are educated on the 15-year maturity cycle of the shark, and crucially, if they're given a seat at the table to design the management plans, the odds of success increase dramatically. It has to be a collaborative effort.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want you to reflect on the sheer weight of this global connection we've uncovered. A bowl of shark fin soup ordered at a luxury banquet in Beijing or Hong Kong is never just a menu item.
It's so much more than that.
The demand for the texture in that single bowl sends a localized economic shockwave across the globe. It dictates the physical safety of a migrant fisher balancing in a wooden canoe in the Gulf of Guinea. It dictates whether his family in a Ghanaian coastal village will have protein to eat or money for fuel. And it directly dictates the fragile ecological balance of the ocean's oldest apex predators.
It is a system deeply entangled in both human survival and ecological destruction. And I want to leave you with a final provocation, a dilemma that arises directly from the study's findings on those middlemen we discussed earlier.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
The researchers noted a very specific behavioral pattern. Once fishers managed to become financially stable, they use that accumulated capital to bypass the intermediaries.
Right. They buy the trucks, they make the contacts, and they trade directly with the final markets, cutting out the middleman to keep the massive international profits for themselves.
Exactly. So here's the dilemma. Imagine that well-meaning global conservationists or international microloan programs succeed in empowering these local fishers financially.
Okay, they provide the capital.
Right. The fishers bypass the intermediaries in Togo and start keeping the full premium profit of the Asian market. What actually happens next? Does keeping the full profit mean a fisher can finally afford to catch fewer sharks because he makes more money per fin, allowing the ecosystem to recover? Or does that sudden access to massive wealth incentivize him to buy a bigger boat, hire a larger crew, and fish for more endangered sharks with devastating efficiency?
Wow, that is a terrifyingly thin line to walk. It's the paradox of efficiency. Sometimes giving people the tools to do less work only encourages them to do more of it.
It forces us to ask a very uncomfortable question. Can pure economic empowerment at the local level and species conservation ever truly coexist in a high-value wildlife trade? Or does solving the human poverty equation inadvertently accelerate the extinction of the shark?
From a coastal canoe in Ghana to a luxury high-rise in China to the survival of a species that has been swimming in our oceans for 400 million years, the invisible thread is pulled incredibly tight, and eventually something has to snap. Think about that next time you consider the true hidden cost of what's on the plate.